Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Sony Pictures, presenting All the King's Men. Sean Penn leads a cast including Sir Anthony Hopkins. All the King's Men is in theaters September 22nd.
I bow to anyone who puts their life on the line to bring us news. And there's a certain crop. Names come to mind. Annie Novot, who is one, and Sarah Chase is the other one, who not only... They go beyond the pack mentality. They live with the people. They, as Sarah did, dress like a man in Afghanistan to get the news. So that's who we're here to learn from tonight. And how fitting it is, I think, that we're here on 9/11, 5 years after the launch of the war against terrorism, about a month from today, 5 years ago, with someone who was there as that war was launched in Afghanistan. And how interesting it is to me that it's Sarah Chase that we're here with, because as she writes, she was one of the pack of reporters pawing to get into Kandahar to watch the Taliban fall. And then she was one of the few who realized that they were missing the real story, which was the rise of the warlords. And how really interesting it is to me to read in her incredible new book, The Punishment of Virtue, that one of the reasons that we didn't hear more about that story after Sarah realized that the pack of journalists was missing it is that our network, NPR, didn't let her report a lot of it. And I'm hoping we hear more from her about that tonight, because that was very disturbing to read. We see the consequences of that today. Just today on Here and Now, we reported on President Hamid Karzai's belated attempts to replace some of the warlords that he put in power several years ago with educated leaders of Afghanistan. And one of them, his very close friend, was assassinated on Sunday by a suicide bomber. Suicide bombs have tripled over the last year in Afghanistan. And all I could picture when I read that news on Sunday was this image that I had of Sarah Chase throughout her book, throughout her reporting from Afghanistan in the early days of the war there. It was an image that I conjured in my mind, not one that she described, but of her grabbing the lapels of anyone who would listen, sometimes across a thuriophone to the NPR networks back in Washington, shaking their lapels and saying, "It's the warlords, stupid." And today we see the consequences of people neglecting that message. Sarah Chase. Oh, don't you just hear it? Sarah Chase, NPR News. It's right up there with Sylvia Fagioli, you know, for names that I just used to love to hear. There was a way that she said it. And we loved when she would come to visit at WBUR. Her reporting was so distinguished, but her wardrobe became more so as she stayed. And, oh, you had yak things and, you know, things made out of native fibers and... But it was, of course, what she said. Sarah was an overseas correspondent for NPR from 1997 to 2002. She reported from Paris, lived there, reported it from the Balkans. During the Kosovo crisis, she, along with a team from NPR, won major awards, including the 1999 Foreign Press Club and Sigma Delta Chi Awards. And then, as I said, she was sent to Afghanistan in 2001. And from there, as one of my colleagues at WBUR said today, yeah, and then she really went off the rez. She did. She had epiphanies that I'm sure she's going to share with us, put down the microphone, took up humanitarian work, learned a lot about that, I think, the hard way, and I think she'll probably share with us. And now she runs another company, an artisan and agribusiness company called Argand.
Argand.
Yeah, pronouncing that. And she just returned from Afghanistan about a month ago and is going back, and I hope tells us more about her life there and also answers the question some of us had, which is, you know, when do you think you might have gone too far? Because in addition to being a humanitarian and a witness to what was going on, she became an impassioned advocate for a certain point of view, and almost ultimately a one-woman embassy annex, with firing off letters to President Karzai, to killer former warlords, now governors with their own militias, you know, scared the heck out of me just reading about it, to Congress in Washington, trying to get across her message of how she thought the war on terrorism had been derailed in Afghanistan. And you know, so it raises a lot of questions about, you know, when are you too enmeshed with the story that you once covered? Answers I hope we get to hear a little more about. But in the meantime, the book, if you had a chance to read it, it tells that history. It also is a history book. Genghis Khan, Kandahar, who knew? Sarah Chase does a lot of the history for us. And it illustrates beautifully this place that is so magical. I just wanted to read one paragraph, if you'll allow me that, before we hear from Sarah herself, because she's not going to read to you tonight. And I thought, well, that's a shame, because you could hear, you should hear, in addition to her exquisite reporting, some of her now exquisite writing. This is about when she is a humanitarian worker living with an Afghan family, dressing like a man, and driving into Kandahar one day. Kandahar, which was the home of the Taliban and their guests, Al-Qaeda, and now has become this chaotic sort of, it's not really clear what it is. Impatient white station wagons push past former Taliban pickup trucks. Two-wheeled taxi wagons drawn by tasseled horses stop for passengers. Minivans with children clinging to the roof racks among the bales and bundles. Overloaded donkey barrows, similar barrows bearing similar burdens, heaved along by men instead of donkeys. Wheeled fruit stands, wheeled popcorn and ice cream stands, bicycles bearing turbaned elders, all of these jostle for room on the lumpy roads. And like shiny dung beetles, the brightly painted three-wheeled rickshaws tootle over, around, under, and through all the various obstacles. Isn't that great? There is something joyous about this riot, and given Kandahar's small size, something inevitably sociable. Lights are flicked in greeting to friends in oncoming cars, hands are raised and conversations pursued regardless of honking tie-ups on either side. And in my case, frequent traffic jams are caused by friendly cops at intersections loping over to shake my hand. I must be the first female they have ever seen behind a wheel. That's the writing of Sarah Chase in Kandahar. As I said, we loved to see her come in her Afghan regalia. And it was also really cool, we thought, that she had gone to school at Shady Hill with Sebastian Younger. For some reason, that also was something that appealed to us. This is a little bit of a Shady Hill reunion here tonight. Without further ado, I'd like to present to you somebody who has been brutally honest in her reporting over the last few years and in this book, Sarah Chase.
I guess maybe I should.
Thank you so much, Robin. That has got to be the most generous introduction I have ever received. There is humor in that book. It's not a heartbreak the entire way. But this is September 11th, and I thought I would address some of the slightly more sober issues that this day evokes. And so, as Robin said, I was a journalist and I stayed behind. And often that is, you know, it's Sarah fell in love with Afghanistan, as some other people do, and stayed behind. And that's true, but that's not quite why I stayed behind. And it's not just that I wanted to shut up already and start doing something either, although that was true. It's also that was right after 9/11, and it felt to me at that time that was this century's equivalent of the assassination of the Archduke, you know? I mean, this, which is what launched the First World War, and in my view, launched the 20th century. This was a moment when the plate tectonics of history were obviously shifting, and I believe that they still are. I believe that the implications of that shift have not yet become clear to us as quickly as they did in the beginning of the 20th century. And it seemed to me that there was a crossroads that was opening up before us as a nation, and given our disproportionate influence in the world at the moment, opening up before the rest of the world too. And I guess that one of the possibilities could be summed up by the words that we all heard shortly after 9/11, with us or against us. That's natural. That's a natural reaction for people to have when they're attacked. Our brothers and sisters were killed in New York, and their friends and their families, our friends and our families were suffering. But I don't actually think that with us or against us is a very sophisticated reaction upon being attacked, nor is it actually a very civilized one, in my view. And we were being talked to in terms of civilization. We were told that this was a clash of civilizations that was opening up. And in fact, I don't believe in the clash of civilizations. I don't believe that we're in some epic fight to the death between Islam and the West. First of all, I don't actually believe that those two entities exist as monolithic entities. I think that both of those words are actually describing very complex and rich civilizations. So I guess it was that I see the fight, to use, you know, for lack of a better word, the fight that we're engaged in this generation differently. I think that it's something that it's a conflict between people on either side of that alleged divide between Islam and the West. The people on either side of that divide who believe in with us or against us, those are one team. And the other team are the people who believe that, you know, we live in an interconnected world that is made up of a lot of different civilizations that are rich and diverse and have a lot to teach each other and a lot to learn from each other. And I felt at that time and in the wake of 9/11 and in the wake of the fall of the Taliban that that's a fight that's worth taking risks for, to combat with us or against us thinking. And that, in my view, that is the challenge facing us today. It's sort of like, again, to give another metaphor, it's like our moral equivalent of the Spanish Civil War, you know? And to me, it seemed very clear that Afghanistan and Kandahar in particular was the front line in this battle. This was the other ground zero. This was the sort of antipode. And that's why I stayed in Kandahar. And so the way that happened is a kind of wild story. I was one of my sources, background sources, not so much on the secrets of what was happening during the anti-Taliban conflict, but sources on Pashtun culture, which could help me to explain, to put in context some rather bewildering events, was the uncle of President Karzai, Uncle Aziz. And when I was leaving after my rotation was finished and I had done my pass-off with my successor in Kandahar, my replacement, I had dinner with Uncle Aziz. And we had a great time and we talked with a good deal of concern about all of the obstacles that would be lying ahead for Afghanistan and what, in particular, the kind of humanitarian free-for-all. He was a little bit worried about that because he had seen it happen in the past. They're sharpening their teeth and sharpening their knives, he said, of all the local as well as international nonprofit organizations that he knew were going to be soaking up a lot of the money that was going to Afghanistan. And this turns out to be a Karzai family trick. I now have come to learn that this is what they do. You get up to go, they very elegantly, you know, walk you to the door, and as you're stepping out the door, they land the real question. And his was, wouldn't you come back and help us? And I said yes. I didn't even register the question, but I said yes. And what ended up happening was that he kind of passed me off to another one of his nephews, Qayyum, who is the older brother of President Karzai and has actually lived in the United States for 30 years and runs some excellent restaurants in Baltimore, Maryland, but had always stayed involved in Afghan politics and things like that, and who had started a nonprofit organization that existed on paper but not yet in fact. And so based on a telephone call probably that had everything to do with how I said my name on the radio and not much else, you know, I'm suddenly, you know, promoted to be head of this non-existent NGO and decide that I'm going to set up its operations, and persuaded him to do this in Kandahar because it seemed to me very important. This was, as I said, the other ground zero, and it was the most conservative part of Afghanistan, but also the country's original capital. And it was clear to me that if this exercise in nation building left Kandahar behind, it wasn't going very very far. And so I convinced him that Kandahar was the place to set up. But the other thing that was interesting was that neither Qayyum nor myself nor my older sister Eve Lyman, whom I roped into this venture, also had any background in humanitarian, I would say in the humanitarian aid industry, because that's what it's really become. And it's come to have all of the rigidities that other well-established industries have. So there are things that you're not supposed to mix and match in humanitarian work. For example, you're not supposed to do stuff like rebuild things and then go and talk about it. You either do policy and then you're in a think tank, or you do reconstruction and then you shut your mouth. Well, we weren't aware of these rules. And I have to say that I still think that our approach made a lot of sense, because it turns out that, for example, the first project that we did was to rebuild a village that had been destroyed in the American bombing. And this was a deliberately political thing to do, because we had heard, along with all of you folks, that this war was against the Taliban regime and not against the Afghan people. And there was this village right next to the airport, which had been destroyed in the bombing, and I don't think it was wrongly destroyed. The airport was where Al-Qaeda had its last stand, and I think Al-Qaeda folks were probably holed up in that village, but they were not the villagers. The villagers had skedaddled by that time because there was a lot of tons of ordnance coming down out of the sky at them, and these people were not Al-Qaeda fighters. So when they came back from Pakistan and neighboring villages and things like that, they come to, you know, half of their village is gone. And it seemed to us very important for what was to follow that Americans be seen rebuilding what Americans had destroyed. And in the end, we couldn't persuade the American government of that, of the wisdom of this notion, but we did persuade some of your neighbors in Concord, Massachusetts, to cough up the money for this. I gave a talk much like this one at the First Parish Church in Concord, and lo and behold, the people of Concord, Massachusetts came up with the money to rebuild this village. So that was our first project, and we encountered various obstacles of various sorts in getting this done, but the most significant obstacle came when our tractor, you know, these are mud brick houses, but we wanted to give them stone foundations, which would make them a little bit more lasting and things like that. And so we send our tractor to the quarry, which is about halfway between Kandahar City and the airport, which is now being used as a military base. So it's about 10 minutes outside of town. And one day, one of the governor's gunmen holds up our tractor and says, "You can't have any of that stone because it belongs to the governor." Now, unfortunately, I don't have any visuals tonight, but if you see any pictures, and you can online, of what Kandahar looks like, you'll see that one of the only things that there's an abundant supply of is rocks. And what I'm trying to say is that I could then go on to speak a whole lot more cogently about the problem of warlordism once it had been my tractor that was held up at gunpoint. And this is what we started to experience very quickly. On a very personal level, we started to experience the fact that good governance was taking a distinct second place to the so-called war on terror. And there are a couple of reasons that this was happening. One has now been abundantly commented upon regarding Iraq. And given the fact that it was also the case in Afghanistan, it makes it even more of a tragedy that it was a case in Iraq. And it's called not having a plan. There was no plan for what was going to happen in Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban. And there was certainly no plan for what was going to happen in a civilian fashion. And so what that meant was that the kind of gunslingers that the military recruited to be proxies in a so-called ground campaign against the Taliban ended up by default in positions of political power. And I, you know, can understand why military planners may have signed these guys up, because they could round up, you know, people who knew how to fire a gun pretty quickly, and we were in a hurry and stuff like that. But those people were definitely not qualified to take over the position, you know, take over the governing of their countrymen after the war. And in fact, when I was reporting, what I was hearing from Afghan refugees in Pakistan and indeed in Kandahar as soon as the Taliban fell was, yeah, we're really glad to see the back of the Taliban, but the one thing we're afraid of is that the warlords are going to come back, because that was the one thing that the Taliban were remembered for with a degree of affection, was that they had extricated these guys from the body politic. And so what we started to see is that, you know, in this case, the governor decides to award himself a monopoly, a private monopoly on a public resource, because the mountains around Kandahar belong to the people. They are not the personal property of the governor. And what we found is that a lot of the people that we had ushered into positions of power were basically preying upon their countrymen. And one day I gathered a group of young people together because we were going to launch a radio station, and I wanted to do some kind of market survey, like what do you want, you know, like what kind of music do you like to listen to and what sorts of programs do you want? And it turns out that within 10 minutes we were talking about security. But when these kids were talking about security, they weren't talking about Taliban. They were talking about their own government. They were suffering insecurity at the hands of their own government. One of the kids who was there speaking with me, his brother had been shot in the leg because one of these gunmen wanted his bicycle. And another kid had witnessed, it didn't happen to him, but there was a wedding procession that went through a checkpoint right near our office, actually. And he watched the soldiers hold up the wedding procession and ask for shirini, which means sweets, but you can imagine what that means. It means money, and the driver didn't come up with any money, and he got shot. He didn't get killed, but this was what people were experiencing, was insecurity visited upon them by their own government. So when I started to, as Robin said, shake people's lapels figuratively in the American government, what I kept hearing back was, well, but we need these people to establish security, you know, because they've got armed forces and they can help us in this war on terror and keep the lid on the terror, and we'll worry about governance later. And my argument was, but they're the cause of insecurity. It's not the kind of insecurity you're talking about, but they're the cause of insecurity. And here we are now, 5 years later, and that's later in my book. And here's what we have. We've got, I think you've been hearing about the Afghan National Army, and in fact, I heard General Jones, who's the head of NATO, I was on Talk of the Nation today with him, and I wasn't able to answer this comment that he made, but he was very proud of the Afghan National Army and how, you know, the United States has been training this Afghan National Army. You know, Afghans are good at fighting, but are they good, disciplined soldiers? Well, I see Afghan National Army soldiers every single day, and I see them shaking down regular people in Afghanistan. I see that when they are deployed in an area where there's been fighting with the Taliban and they're supposed to check people coming by, they relieve people of their money, of their telephone, you know, portable telephones. There's no landline system to this day in Kandahar, so the only way to communicate by telephone is cell phones. They take people's opium. Now, that's a nice thing because we're all against opium, but they don't take it to burn it. They take it so they're going to go sell it. And that is people's experience of the Afghan National Army, not to mention the fact that many of them don't speak the language of southern Afghanistan. And so they are treating the locals in southern Afghanistan like subjects, really. I run a cooperative now, and to be registered as a cooperative, you have to put some money in the national bank that's supposed to be your money that your cooperative can draw upon in various ways. So you have to, you know, to deposit this money in the bank, there are various little receipts that they have to write out for you. My treasurer went to make this deposit, and he comes back and he said, Sarah, I didn't deposit the money because they want 500 Afghanis, that's about $10, in a bribe. They say they won't give us a receipt for it. And I said, I'll take care of that, you know. So we go marching back into the bank the next day, and the guy wants his 500 Afghanis, and I say, I'm sorry, I'm responsible. I've got a board of directors. I can't give you money without something that explains what it was used for. So we go to the his superior, and I explain this out, and the superior says, you know what, she's right. If you can't give her a receipt, you know, meaning he can't have his bribe. So he writes out the five other receipts for the various actions that this deposit entails, and then he says, well, I need 20 Afghanis a receipt. So I pull out 100 Afghanis. I say, here's your money, but could you please give me a receipt for it? We're back where we started from. And he says, no, he can't give me a receipt. I put the money back in my pocket, and I say, then you can't have your money. And he says, well, then you can't have your, you know, little cash book until tomorrow. And I don't know how it happened, but the next thing was that I'm sitting on his desk, cross-legged, amidst his papers, and I cross my arms and I say, well, then I'm not leaving until tomorrow. And the result is that we get our work finished in about 5 minutes. But I can do that. Believe it or not, as an American, I'm actually safer in Afghanistan than a lot of Afghans are. And there is no way that a regular Afghan would dare take somebody on like that because they would be afraid that they would get beaten or they would get hauled off to jail or something like that. And that is people's experience with this government that we brought to power. And the last example that I'll give you is the recent, relatively recent parliamentary elections, I guess it's almost a year ago now. And here again is an example of how interesting it is to be on the other side of the microphone, as it were, and be observing my former colleagues and how they work. So there's this parliamentary election, and suddenly you have the descent of the journalists. We haven't seen any in Kandahar for 2 years, and suddenly there's this kind of cloud of locusts, you know, that descends on town. And they show up about 2 days before the election. They do their setup pieces. They cover the day of the election, and then they leave. Now, okay, I can forgive the Europeans, but surely the American journalists remember that the important day of an election is not the day when people cast their ballots, it's the day when the vote is counted, right? How did we forget this? So there were 10 days of free-for-all that went utterly uncovered. I mean, it was, I'm a campaign worker, how much does it cost to get a zero added to my candidate's score? We had ballot boxes showing up with all the ballots written in the same color ink and having the same name on them, of course. We had ballot boxes that went home to people's houses because their women, of course, couldn't be asked to go outside to vote, so, you know, they had to vote at home. And meanwhile, all sorts of other votes get put in the, I mean, it was insane. And so, you know, I'm often asked this question, are we right? Is it fair? Do we have the right to impose democracy on a people that just might not be ready for it or might not wish to have democracy? And I guess that my answer to that in my more cynical moods is that we're imposing American democracy as we are currently experiencing it. And I don't believe that that is the best that America has to offer the world. And what I've found in Afghanistan is that setting certain major issues aside, like the role of women, give me grace on the role of women, but that aside, Afghans want from their government pretty much what we want from ours, which is to say infrastructure that functions, schools where they can send their kids, you know, doctors who have learned some medicine so that when they make prescriptions, you know, give out prescriptions, your kids aren't going to get poisoned by taking the pills that they write down. And this is not what they're getting. They also want real participation in their collective destiny in one form or another. And this, unfortunately, is not what they've been getting over the last 5 years, and it takes us back to the issue of governance. You know, we decided, okay, we'll think about governance later. But so what I want to say is that this is the context in which you all can begin to understand, I think, the current Taliban resurgence, for lack of a better word. It is not an indigenous uprising that's coming from the grassroots inside Afghanistan. It is not that. And there are various ways that you can tell that, apart from, you know, some evidence about how involved Pakistan is, which I can provide you with later. But there's some really, you know, I was driving to Kabul recently and picked up a I think he was probably 12 or 13 years old, boy, who went to school. This was in the province immediately to the north of Kandahar. And he went to school in the provincial capital, and he lived in the village that is, you know, totally Taliban haven. And so we were just chatting with this boy in the car, you know, well, what's it like? How, you know, what's the deal with the Taliban in your village? And he said, man, you know, it's full of them. And they're up in the hills above our village. And then they come down every night. There's 15 motorcycles and they come down to get the food. And so that to me implies that there's probably 10 people are being fed by each motorcycle. And so then we asked him, well, are they your neighbors? Are they people from around your village? And he said, no, I can tell from the way they talk. They're either from Kandahar province or Helmand province or, you know, during the anti-Soviet resistance in the 1980s, resistance fighters fought out of their own villages. That's how a real grassroots insurgency works. It's people fight from the places that they are very familiar with and where they really have a lot of local support. But it's not a local insurgency when you're, you know, playing a shell game with your fighters. However, what I'd like to say is that, you know, okay, sorry. However, although this isn't, you know, springing up from the grassroots, there is a certain amount of space being made for the Taliban. In other words, I believe that it's basically an invasion, schematically described. It's an invasion from Pakistan, but local villagers are making some space, like that kid's family is providing food for these people. But the reason this is happening is not ideological. This is really counterintuitive, but it's one of the first things that I came to understand in Kandahar, is that Afghans are just about the least ideological people I've ever met. And that, you know, they've been through three revolutions in the last less than 30 years, and they've had it with ideology. They're vaccinated at this point. But they are experiencing their own government as a predator, as I just described. I mean, in this cooperative of mine, there's one of the women who works with us is extremely moving in the way that she describes how she's feeling about things. And she came in one day and she said, man, we're like, we don't know what to do anymore because we've got one foot on one watermelon. This is a local expression. And another foot on another watermelon. And she said, you know, the Taliban are preying on us at night like they're preying on that little boy's village. And the government is preying on us in the daytime. And the fact is that in this context, you know, people are remembering, yes, the Taliban had appalling strictures in terms of personal freedoms. And believe me, these strictures had impact on men as well as women. For example, when I just drove up to Kabul, two guys from my cooperative who drove with me, who normally wear sort of sparkly caps, which are the local fashion in Kandahar, they tied on whopping black turbans to make that drive. And that's when the Taliban aren't running the government. But people also remember that they could drive to Kabul without danger under the Taliban regime. And they remember that there was no corruption, at least not on the level that I'm talking about. There might have been corruption that I've asked people repeatedly. And when I push them, they say, well, you know, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, at that level, you know, if someone was going to be executed, you might be able to buy him off. It's not like today where public office is for sale, openly for sale in Afghanistan. And they remember that the Taliban actually sort of knew how to run a railroad. Like, you know, if you needed to get your car licensed, it would happen in a couple of days. This story I told you about the bank when we were depositing our money, this was after we had had to harass the Department of Agriculture for 7 solid months to get registered. You know, you would have those kinds of administrative things, they would get done in a timely fashion under the Taliban. And so this is why people are beginning, to some degree, to make some room, because the government seems at least as hostile to their interests as the Taliban are, and because the Taliban, are now being ranked. When I ask people to rank the governments, we get the communists are the best, not under the Soviets, but after the Soviets withdrew. There were another couple of years when the communists were still in power. That was the best. Next is the Taliban. Next is us. And last is the totally violent and chaotic civil war. So I submit that had we focused on governance, had we focused on governance in the beginning, things wouldn't look the way they look today. Had we focused on what I believe to be American values, like common decency, like respect for and attentiveness to the governed, like accountability, like genuine participation in the process by the people and for the people, then, you know what? The Afghan people would not tolerate the presence of Taliban in their midst. So I guess the moral, or another moral of all of this, has to do with getting to know people. We're back to us versus them. I mean, this book is partly the story of how, you know, you get close enough to people who seem to be different from us, however you might define us, you know, and get close enough to them to be able to understand their perspective. And I think that's something we all really need to make an effort to do every single day, be that in Boston, Massachusetts, where I understand that the rate of violent death among young people is just about the same as the rate of violent death among Canadian soldiers in Kandahar, or in Iran, for example, or in Afghanistan. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming out, and we're going to turn this into a dialogue very quickly. Yes, Robin?
You left out the part, where you were standing outside the Governor Reed murderous warlord's house, and he drove by you for like the seventh day in a row, and you stood in front of his car with your finger up and you said, stop. And he stopped and got out. We are going to turn this into a dialogue. And if you have a question for Sarah, just come up. I think there's, is there more than one microphone? One
microphone.
I think
there's only one in the middle here.
Come on up to the microphone. I'll start with one while you get yourself up there. And please just form the line and we'll get to as many questions as we can. I talked to David Rowe today from the New York Times, who just wrote a terrific piece about Afghanistan, just returned a little while ago. He says that what's happening there now is a proxy war between India and Pakistan, that Pakistan is backing the Taliban because the Taliban offsets Indian influence in Afghanistan. Your thoughts?
I don't think India is anything like as active in Afghanistan as Pakistan is, and I don't think it's really fair to say it's a proxy war. What I think is happening is that Pakistan has a paranoia about India, and that's why it's so interested in controlling Afghanistan, which it has been interested in consistently for the last 30 years. So I think there's some truth to that, but I don't see Indians, you know, arming people to fight against mm-hmm. Taliban or against any proxy of Pakistan's in Afghanistan.
Okay, sir.
Yeah, the most surprising thing that I heard you say, and it really was very striking to me, was that the most popular government was the post-Soviet communist government. Why was that, and why did it not endure? Was that because of internal or external forces?
I think, and in particularly in Kandahar, the post-Soviet communist government was popular because the governor was really acting within local traditions of conciliation and dispute resolution. And what he did was ask the insurgents, the Mujahideen, they were called at the time, please don't commit suicide. You know, they never were committing suicide attacks, but don't commit attacks that are going to kill civilians. Why are we fighting among Afghans now? You know, this doesn't need to continue. And any of you who need to come into Kandahar for whatever reason, you can come in and we will not kill you. You have an amnesty. And he lived by that. And people will never forget that he put a lid on this post-Soviet bloodshed that was happening elsewhere. So where Kabul was basically, I mean, Kabul looked like Grozny after, you know, during this post-Soviet factional fighting. Parts of it were totally leveled. That did not happen in Kandahar. All the damage to buildings in Kandahar took place were Soviet-caused damage. That was one. And the reason that this didn't survive is because of Pakistan. Again, I hate to say it, but Pakistan, the Pakistani government at that time also was really interested in controlling Afghanistan. The issue was called strategic depth, which I'm not quite sure what that actually means, but if you look at a country that's thinking a lot about India, they want to have kind of a vacant lot at their backyard, at their back, or a friendly government at their back, or one that they can control. And so they had been handing over a lot of American money. We gave Pakistan a lot of money to support the anti-Soviet resistance. And what Pakistan did was funnel most of that money to the guy that they wanted to take over Afghanistan after the Soviets withdrew. And his name was Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. And a lot of ways, he was a precursor to the Taliban. And so they didn't want to see that, local communist government stay alive. They wanted to see this extremist... they were at that time consciously manipulating religious extremism as a kind of tool in a regional strategy. So that's why that didn't happen. There was they continued to pour money into their favorite resistance factions in order to bring down that communist government.
Just jump in for a quick question. Yeah. And you write this as well, but is that why you also write that the infighting among the warlords was what created the need for the Taliban
to
rise
absolutely.
And suppress it.
Yeah, what happened was that guy was never able to really conquer the country. They didn't want him. Afghanistan, I told you, it's not an ideological country, and they didn't want this brand of radical Islam. That's not to say that it's not a conservative country. Of course it is, but there's a difference. There's a very subtle difference. And he was pretty roundly booted out of Kandahar right after the Soviets were booted out. So what you got instead of this guy taking over the government was total chaos. So then what the Pakistani government did was say, oops, this horse isn't going to win the race. Let's come up with another horse. And they basically ginned up the Taliban movement. And by that time, Afghanistan was so exhausted from, what was it, about almost 5 years of really violent chaos that they were willing to accept what was radical, a radical Islamic movement. Ma'am.
Our son is in the army, and he was in Afghanistan during the election, and he had also been in Iraq during that election, and he was extremely impressed with the Afghanis. You know, he just said there's such a difference between the two. Given that he may have to go back there again, do you have some advice on how Americans, and particularly American soldiers, can sort of win the respect, be part of the people there instead of being seen as part of an occupying force?
That's the real tragedy of the Afghan story, is it is not Iraq. And I was in Kandahar when the Taliban fell, and okay, people weren't jumping up and down and standing online to shave off their beards. It's a sober place. I mean, it's a place where the manners are quite formal. It's wild because it's both unruly and formal. It's quite self-contradictory in people's manners. But people were not, standing online at barbershops. But everybody that I talked to was really interested in this post-Taliban experiment, I guess I can call it, in nation building, and saw it as, the chance that might winch them out of their 30-year nightmare. And so the fact that 5 years later they've finally become durably disillusioned is a real tragedy. And so I have a hard time at this stage telling you how an American ought to behave, because people are pretty disillusioned. And the problem is that, this is going to be another shocker. Everybody in Kandahar, but everybody, is convinced that we are actually allied to the Taliban. And the reason they think that is I just explained how the anti-Soviet resistance worked, that we funneled, you know, something like $250 million a year into the anti-Soviet resistance for a decade. And we did that via Pakistan because that was the Cold War and we couldn't be directly funding a fighting force that was, you know, fighting against the Soviet Union. We'd have nuclear war on our hands or we might. So the way we did it, it was this kind of fiction that everybody, you know, kind of winked at. We gave the money to Pakistan and Pakistan gave the money to these factions. Well, guess what? In 2003, we provided the Pakistani government with, $3 billion over a five-year period. And the Pakistani government is ginning up the current Taliban resurgence. So you're a Kandahari and you say, well, this looks just like what was happening in the 1980s. This America must be doing this on purpose because believe me, the logic of it has got me, even me, confused. So I can really understand that it's got Afghans confused. So for an American soldier, the problem is that depending on what his job is, the restrictions on getting off the base are often very high. I would urge him to learn the language as much as he can, even if it's a couple of expressions. People really are moved when you make the effort to learn even just how to say hello in a proper way in their language.
Can you share some?
Salamu alaikum is the way to say hello, but kazu tatawayam tazma khurye tazma amkariye. I'm saying that you're my sister and you're my co-work, you know, what do we say?
Colleague. Co-work?
Colleague, that's what I'm saying. It is an Iranian it's in the Iranian language group, but it is not the same as Farsi, which is also called Persian, which is also called Dari, which is spoken in Iran and Afghanistan and Tajikistan. So it's, you know, that whole region. It's related, but I don't speak Persian. I don't. So when I go to Kabul, for example, I have to apologize to shopkeepers and say, I'm terribly sorry, but do you speak Pashto? And then they burst out laughing because here's this foreigner who not only speaks Pashto, but has this very strong southern accent. You know, which to them sounds like a Talib, you know. So that's one thing. The other thing is to be alert to somebody's tribal affiliations. Again, depending on where the soldier or officer is stationed. In Kandahar, what happened, and that story is told in this book, is that the U.S. Army got very tied up with one particular tribe, the tribe that belonged to this warlord governor. So from the perspective of the rest of town, it was like the Americans were the private army that belonged to one tribe, and there were five major tribes. And they didn't understand. They said, oh, but I thought you guys were coming to serve the whole, you know, to help the whole country move forward. And here you are, basically being monopolized by one tribe. And that was a way, and they were not aware of these tribal distinctions. And then what happened was these rotations happen every 6 to 9 months or a year. And so whatever one rotation learned, the next rotation didn't know it. And even worse, often no matter what one rotation learned, the next rotation would deliberately do the opposite because there's this kind of unit rivalry thing going on. And so this, again, I experienced because if I would develop a relationship with the base commander, for example, the next base commander that came in wouldn't speak to me. And this happened, you know, basically 4 times in a row. Ma'am.
This is all fascinating and horrifying. You mentioned, this may be just a larger, a different version of the question that was just asked, but you mentioned what we should have done prior to going in the way of planning and looking ahead for what would happen after the invasion. So rather than looking back,
what do we do
now? Moving forward, what would you recommend that we do now?
Okay. That is an excellent question and a very difficult one. That was the question I didn't want to get asked because, you know, what I'm doing and, you know, talk to my mom sometime who happens to be in the room, you know, what I'm doing is totally irrational because I don't see, looking at this with my intellect, I don't see a lot of hope. I don't see any evidence that this thing is going to turn around. So what am I doing going back to Kandahar in 2 months and, ramping up my soap business that is going to involve having people plant roses whose flowers we're not going to be able to harvest for a year or two. You know, we're talking long term in a place that's a battlefield. So part of me says, I think it may be too late. There are two tipping points that I've seen. One is that villages where I have worked in the past are now politely asking me not to come and visit, not to buy their pomegranates. I mean, the whole point of this is I want to expand the market for licit local agriculture, and that means I want to buy people's pomegranates. And there are villages that actually asked me, please get involved in fruit because this is our mainstay. And when I talked to one of these villages' elder last fall, actually, I said, you know, okay, now I'm ready. I need your pomegranates. And he said, look, Sarah, I'd really rather you buy them on the wholesale market in Kandahar proper. Don't come to our village because we're going to get retaliated against. So when you have people who are now afraid to receive the aid and development assistance that was supposed to turn the country around, you're at a place where it's going to be hard to make a positive difference. The second tipping point is qualified people in government, which, again, was my hobby horse for the first 4 years that I was there. I was extremely distressed when, in my usual style, I barge into the office of a very talented man who runs a UN agency and said, you have to run for mayor of this town because you are the guy who's going to be able to do something with it. And we discussed this, and we discussed some of the issues that he was concerned about. I mean, he took it on board, but he had a couple of very serious reservations. And then I found out that later the governor actually offered him the job, and he turned it down. When you've gotten to the point that people, number one, are too afraid, or number two, don't wish to be associated with this government, then again, it's very hard to think about how to turn it around. That said, what I wish the American officials and other international officials in Afghanistan would do is start holding these people accountable. I mean, the fact is, we brought them to power. They wouldn't be in power if it weren't us. We are funding them, so we actually have a right to ask them for a certain degree of respect toward their fellow citizens. And that doesn't mean we should run the country for them. But this is what Afghans were begging me from the beginning to do, because these, you know, these local warlords, you know, Afghanistan does have democratic structures. It has a tribal system, which is actually, again, setting the issue of women aside, and that's a big thing to set aside. It is a democratic institution, and it's a place, it's a consensus-building institution. It's not one person, one vote in a private, you know, ballot kind of situation, but it's a place where if somebody wants to do something, they've got to achieve a consensus of the leading members of their community, be it a village or a district or a province. And the problem was that during the anti-Soviet resistance, as I said, a lot of money and weapons were being pumped into the hands of some of these tribal elders. So all of a sudden, they are out of control of their fellow citizens. Their fellow citizens no longer have the leverage to rein these guys in. And they were really aware of that. So people were saying to me, you guys have to ride herd on these warlords because we can't do it, and we can't do it from the bottom up, and the central government is apparently not doing it from the top down, so you guys have to do it. And again, at the risk of making the people who are standing online making their feet hurt, I'd like to tell just another story, which, again, I really don't want to make this sound like I'm tooting my own horn, but this is the kind of thing that I would like to see American officials doing. I'm a member of the Manufacturers Union since we manufacture soap, and I started going to their, you know, I decided, well, heck, I'll go to their meetings. And these are wonderful people who are concerned with really practical issues, like the electricity supply. There are two kinds of electricity in Kandahar. One is good and one is bad. And the good electricity goes to basically the governor's palace and a neighborhood that is inhabited by the former governor's cronies. And the bad electricity goes to everybody else. And if you're trying to run heavy machinery and you've got electricity that is literally, you know, on a minute-by-minute basis, oscillating between about 180 volts and about 230 volts, you're going to burn out your machines. And it also cuts off very frequently. And so the factory owners were saying, you know, all we want is 8 hours of reliable electricity. And the other thing they needed was title to the land that had been improved with USAID, that's our overseas development agency, USAID funds, as an industrial zone. But the provincial officials were basically hanky-panking around with them because they wanted the, you know, they wanted the people to build the factories so the value of the land would go up, and then they were supposed to pay for their land. And the guys are saying, we can't work under these conditions. So they had been trying to get into the governor to deal with these issues, and he was just not interested. And because of this, the other wild thing about my NGO was the one I used to work for at that was run by President Karzai's older brother, is that it gave me this preposterous degree of access to, you know, the movers and shakers that was way out of proportion. This is something that Robin raised earlier, way out of proportion to who I was personally or certainly to the impact or size of our NGO. So I'm in a position where I can actually talk to the governor whenever I want. And there was a meeting and, you know, he actually pulled me into his office in the middle of the meeting. And I said, look, you've got to solve this electricity problem. And he said, look, I don't want to talk about electricity. I said, you have to talk about electricity. This is your job. And he said, call me tomorrow. And I said, no, that's not good enough. Here's your calendar. And we opened up his calendar, and it turns out that he had no meeting scheduled between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. And I said, write us in for 11 o'clock. And I do this in a kind of joking way, which is how I get away with this. You know, I don't think I could probably boss people around in Boston, but to give him credit, he called in the head of the electricity department and the and from the municipality, and it took a couple of meetings over about 2 weeks, but the problems got solved. And what I'm saying is this is what U.S. officials ought to be doing. And the reason I think that I became a plenipotentiary ambassador from nobody is because I felt that U.S. officials weren't doing what we had told the Afghans we were going to do and what the Afghans were really asking us to do. Ma'am.
Can I just interrupt?
Yes, please. Sorry.
Come to the mic. You're all doing wonderfully.
Just be careful
not to go off mic.
We're
recording this for here now
right.
and for other things. So just be
right.
You're all doing great, though.
So I should know better.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing this. My question is, considering the reported oppressive patriarchal attitude towards women in the country, and you being a leader from outside the country, what was their attitude towards you and women in general?
Okay, that's two very different questions, because what turns out to be the case for foreign women working in Muslim countries is that they're a third sex. And it turns out to be the best thing that you want to be is a foreign female, because it means that you can hang out with the women, but you can boss the men around if you are so inclined. And there's actually, in one of the passages that I do sometimes read when I read from this book, the previous governor of Kandahar, the one that I was really tangling with, got really upset with me at some point and actually complained about me to President Karzai, and he called me a Narshizai, which is an extremely rude term for a mannish woman, shall we say. And he said, get that Narshizai out of my province or I'm going to quit. And it's a very interesting question in terms of my own gender identity, because I also have men working for me, and they are proud of their masculinity. So it becomes an issue. They are now known around town as, you know, working for Sarah. And there are various things that some of these traffic cops who now know my truck and stuff like that will say to them, like, you know, you're Sarah's guy, or sometimes you're Sarah's boy. And that has a very specific implication in southern Afghanistan, where mature male on immature male homosexuality is very common. So what that means is that that guy is the subordinate partner in a homosexual, basically abusive homosexual relationship. So we get that. And sometimes we play on that ourselves, because when I do dress in my rig when we're driving around, driving out of Kandahar, in one case, at a checkpoint, I was not driving the car at that time, at that particular stage, and the soldier asked my colleague who was driving whether I was his boy, and we both assured him that I was, because that was the best way to, and so there are these lewd winks that get passed around and stuff like that. But the other point has to do with the, and as a woman I don't approve of this, but the implications of the word man. Afghans, and this is again quite counterintuitive, they are very frightened people. They get a lot of credit for being, fearsome and bloodthirsty and stuff like that, but they've also been through 30 years of civil war, and that means that as a society, they're basically suffering collective post-traumatic stress disorder. And that means that they cannot psychologically live up to their own ideals of courage. And I appear to. I mean, I jump up on the desk and say I'm not paying a bribe. And so I'm often described, once the older brother of one of my cooperative members was with us, and, there was the joke goes around, is Sarah a man or a woman? And he says, Sarah is men. And that was a really moving thing for him to say. But that said, I also have a relationship with the men in my cooperative that is quite unique, because it is such a conservative society, men often can't talk about intimate things with anybody. They can't talk about intimate things with their own male friends because it's simply off limits. You can't talk about your relationship with your wife or the fact that you want some birth control or, So I become the person who hears about the miscarriage, who hears, who's asked to bring some birth control, who gets to see the bite marks on people's arms and stuff like that. It's a really unbelievable kind of role that I've come to play. That has nothing to do with the life that Afghan women lead, and that remains very unchanged. I mean, just to say it briefly, it's very unchanged since the time of the Taliban. It's no longer imposed by law, but nobody goes out in the street without a burqa in Kandahar. They do in Kabul. Kabul, things are beginning to change. In the north, things are beginning to change, and you get this sort of Sharia fashion that you start to see in other parts of the Middle East, where people remain covered in the appropriate Sharia way, but they start to take some liberties with style and things like that. But certainly the burqa also, everyone understands that the burqa is not Sharia, that there is nothing in Islam that says your face has to be covered. And pretty much everyone, men as well as women, are not that happy about that. And yet the social construct is still such that people don't feel comfortable going out with their faces uncovered. On the other hand, within our cooperative, and this was also very important to me to have men and women, I didn't want to just do a women's program. I thought it would be even more revolutionary to have men and women working together in the same space. And there is some privacy for women so that, most of their space is kind of shielded by a rush mat, so that they can roll up their sleeves, which again is not appropriate in Sharia. And if you're shucking pomegranates, you want to roll up your sleeves. But they interact with the men beautifully. They don't cover their faces inside the compound. It's a very respectful mutual relationship between them, almost maternal and filial, because the women are just about a generation older than most of the men working with me. Ma'am, am I staying okay?
Oh,
okay. I mean, on mic. Right. Okay.
I wanted to let the audience know about a wonderful film that featured you that I saw at the Human Rights Film Festival, International Film Festival. I don't know the name of it. I'm wondering if you do.
There are two versions of it. One that is longer was originally aired on the Sundance Channel, and it's called Life After War. And the other was aired on Frontline a couple of times, actually, under the title A House for Haji Baba, which is a great title. And it's basically the story of this showdown with the governor over the stone. What was incredible was that this documentary team, they wanted to do a kind of straight story about, you know, girl reporter turns girl do-gooder, and, you know, we rebuild a village in Afghanistan. And what they got was this showdown with the governor over public resources. And it's all on camera. It's really amazing. Thank you for bringing that up.
It truly is. And while you're a great storyteller, I learned so much from watching that I do want to encourage everybody to see it. My question for you is, what is your view now of Hamid Karzai? Mm. And, you know, he's got these connections to the Boston area. One of his relatives runs a restaurant here as well, the Helmand. And he's Western educated, and he certainly always seems to mean very well when I see him on tape. But certainly the country's going to hell in a handbasket, as you're describing, under his watch. So does that make him the well-meaning person who the U.S. never gave enough resources to, or does it make him the person who's going along to get along to save his own neck so he doesn't get killed? Or what?
That's a very difficult question for me to answer, particularly in a public venue, because I got adopted by the Karzai family, and I got adopted by that family almost, I have to wonder about their judgment, frankly, because it wasn't like they did a background check on me or anything, and suddenly I'm a member of the family. And Robin was talking about these letters that I would fire off to President Karzai. It was the brothers who asked me to do that. We would get into these discussions in the house in Kandahar, and, you know, Shawali, another one of the brothers, would say, "Sarah, man, I was just arguing with him on the phone about that yesterday, and he won't listen to me. Maybe he'll listen to you. Would you write him a letter?" And so this started this kind of epistolary relationship with President Karzai. The brothers would hand deliver, you know, these missives of mine. And I have never experienced at their hands anything but real kindness and generosity and and being there, particularly Ahmed Wali, the younger brother who is kind of the de facto tribal elder in Kandahar. I could stay at his house whenever I needed to. And if I needed guards, he was willing. I never did, but he often said to me, you know, if you need some guys with guns, I've got them. You just ask me. And I do have a gun of his, actually. But I have to say that I am very disappointed in President Karzai. Now, the level of my disappointment is, of course, equivalent probably to the level of my expectations, which were absurdly high. But I submit about President Karzai and about the United States and how it's seen in the world. When you set yourself up as a paragon of virtue, people tend to get very upset when you fall significantly short of that mark. And so, you know, while American or Karzai's activities may not be much worse than those of our equivalents or his equivalents among peers, they do fall very far short of how we're describing ourselves and how he described himself. I think that President Karzai was doomed. I mean, that was part of why, actually, I stopped reporting and decided to help him, is because this guy, here is our decade's answer to Nelson Mandela. And I'm not saying he was the equivalent, because you only get one or two of those a century. But I'm saying, you know, this was our decade's inspirational leader. And the forces he was up against were just ridiculous. So what do you have to do but help him? You know, you've got to get in there with him. But what I found is that, you know, on the one hand, the forces were terrible. And it is true. It's not only that he didn't get enough resources. I think that had the resources that he got been more effectively distributed, they, you know, would have made for a very different picture than what we're seeing today. But he did get, you know, this thing about the warlords. And there was a time, which is described in this book, that he finally decided, I want to get rid of half a dozen of them. And again, I mean, he didn't do this very well. And there were ways that he needed to take on board that the United States was about to invade Iraq and had its attention diverted, and that if he was going to sell this thing, he had to really sell it. He had to figure out, how do Americans think, and how can I package this thing in such a way that it's not going to give them gray, you know, white hair? And he didn't bother with that. And so the result was the Americans got white hair, and they said, not now, please. You know, now, that wasn't fair. I mean, we basically were telling him, anything you want, Mr. Karzai, and then when he told us what he wanted, we said no. And so he didn't get the kind of support. We didn't come through for him, or our government didn't come through for him the way that it said it would. However, he is president of the country, and he did have a lot of occasions on which to make some moves, and he didn't do it. And had I been in his position, and I get the entire American government telling me, no, you know, you can't fire these guys, I would have said, look, I'm really sorry, but I am the president of a sovereign nation, and if you don't want me to do this, then I'm going to resign. And once you don't resign, then you take responsibility for what follows. And I actually saw him on my way out because we do have this relationship. And even though I'm saying things that I think probably hurt his feelings, first of all, I feel that I have the responsibility to let him in on what I'm about to say before I say it, you know. So he does have a copy of this book and he does know what's in it. And, you know, he asked me why I seem not to have been going out and around much in Kandahar recently. And I said, honestly, Mr. President, I can't walk out my door without an example of the kinds of things I was just describing to you guys in terms of how members of his government treat his people. And I said, I just can't bear to watch it every day. And he was pretty taken aback. And he said, every single day you see something like that? And I said, you know, this is the security problem. The security problem is governance. And you have got to clean up this predatory behavior and this corruption, you know, that is being perpetrated by your people. And he tells me, have some patience. This is what he always tells me. Be patient, Sarah, you know, because I've just appointed this dynamite new Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and he is going to start cleaning this thing up, and it's not going to happen right away, but it's going to start to trickle down in a couple of months. And I say, great, I'm really glad that you've done that. And then I discover afterwards that he, in fact, did not appoint this guy. He appointed the old, corrupt, reactionary, I mean, absolutely reactionary Sharia law proponent as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And it was the parliament that said, we're not having him back, and rammed down President Karzai's throat this other guy. So I have to say that he may feel betrayed by me, by certain things that I've said in this book, but I think we all, and I'm speaking, I shouldn't dare, you know, have the presumption to do that, but Afghans feel betrayed by him, and so do I. Sir.
I want to know how it is that the U.S. government and the Army and our allies forgot how to do this, because by 1950, Germany and Japan were stable. They were well on their way to self-government. There were no guerrilla wars going on in these places, and they were basically well on the way to becoming autonomous states again. So it seems like the U.S. used to know what to do with a country after a military victory, and somehow that knowledge did not get passed on over the generations. What happened?
Well, you'd have to ask the government that. I mean, it would be a really interesting thing to ask whether anybody in the current government has studied the Marshall Plan. We all get this expression, the Marshall Plan, bandied about all the time, but what was interesting to me was I was supposed to give a talk, which I didn't end up giving, in Potsdam at the 50th anniversary of when, you know, the agreement was signed that, you know, basically parceled out post-war Europe and stuff like that. So I go into the Harvard coup to bone up on the thing because I needed to learn, if I was going to try to make a comparison, I needed to learn how did it actually work in post-war Europe. And what I found was there were no books on the shelves that dealt with post-war Europe. You had a lot of books in the coup about World War II. And then you had a lot of books about individual countries after World War II, but I was stunned that in this kind of a university community with this many underemployed historians, including ones that are in school, that nobody had thought about writing, at this day and age, had thought about writing a book about how this post-war Europe, I mean, I'm sure there is one someplace, but there's not a recent enough one for it to be on the shelves. And the second point is that
alien society to us than Europe.
Right. But I think it has to do with means. Everyone has to read Fiasco. You have to read my book first, but then you can read Fiasco, and you're going to see how there was a consistent effort to do this on the cheap. And there has been a Brookings study that looked at post-war experiences since the Marshall Plan, and there is a direct correlation between how much time and how many people and how much money is spent and how well it works. And if we think that we can do Afghanistan in a year and then do Iraq, and do them both well, we're out of our minds.
Thank you.
Last year, I think the funds for Afghanistan were cut by 30% by Congress. I just want to mention, these are the last two. Lucky questioners, and then everyone's going to have a chance to say hi to Sarah at the reception afterwards, but our last two questions here.
And I'd just like to add a coda to this previous one, that a lot of people also ask me about, did you feel a devastating difference when the Iraq War started? And what you'll also find out in Fiasco, which is what we experienced, and it was totally inexplicable to us, is there was never any flood of aid into Afghanistan and flood of focus on Afghanistan that was abruptly ended in the spring of 2003, because those resources started getting pulled off of Afghanistan in 2002. So that's how this didn't work.
I wanted to ask what Robin alluded to at the beginning, that you were told by your editors at NPR that they didn't really want to have you report on what she referred to as it's the warlords, stupid. I mean, among reporters, I'm a journalist myself, there's the story that goes around, you have a good story, well, pitch it to us, and yeah, go out and report it. And apparently this was not the case, in a nutshell. Could you talk a little bit about that?
This was a really, you rarely talk about your employer as your family, but I was an NPR addict long before I ever dreamt that I would be reporting for NPR. I used to work at the Wine and Cheese Cask in Somerville, and I had control over the radio. And so I inflicted NPR on all of my customers. And so this was a place that I loved viscerally, the way one loves one's family. So it came as a pretty devastating, and I had only experienced what you describe, which was I pitch a story and it pretty much goes. You know, if you can come up with the stuff for it, you know, go ahead. I almost never had a story turned down. And if it was, you know, for not substantive reasons. Here I am about to set sail for, you know, arguably at that time, the most dangerous place for an American to want to be, which was at that point Quetta, Pakistan, with the promise of Kandahar when the Taliban fell. And so I was I had some trepidation. I had worked in hostile places before, but I had a degree of trepidation about how it was going to work out for an American to be wandering around the streets with a microphone. What didn't dawn on me was going to be difficult about this assignment was the reaction I was going to be getting from back home. And I have to say that 9/11 really kind of blew out the critical thinking apparatus of a lot of us, including, unfortunately, the people that American citizens pay to have one, which is the editors at places like NPR. And so what happened was I started getting, you know, stories were actually not being accepted or were receiving very, very caustic comments from my colleagues. I mean, it's one thing when you have listeners who heap abuse on you for doing a civilian casualty story, which, you know, I can handle that because I had an answer to that NPR, you had to look at NPR coverage as a whole, and you couldn't expect me to be reporting about what had happened in New York on 9/11 when I'm in Chaman, Pakistan. I mean, that, you know, we've got a New York bureau that was covering that story. But the first thing that happened was a colleague, not an editor, but a very revered colleague of mine who had been like one of my models at NPR. There was this very weird scene when Kabul fell. And we made the same mistake that the Soviets made before us and that we made in Iraq, which is to think that when you capture the capital of the country, you've got the country. And this wasn't the case. It wasn't the case, first of all, because if they had known anything about Afghanistan, they would have understood that these are the military planners, that the real capital of the country was Kandahar, that Kabul was like a shadow capital where Mullah Omar basically kicked upstairs the people that he didn't want bothering him while he was running the government from Kandahar. So he gave these people these ministries, but they were not running the government. He was in Kandahar. So capturing Kabul didn't mean a lot. And the second thing is that Afghanistan as a whole has often used this real interesting trick to survive when it gets invaded, which is that it dissolves itself as a nation. It reduces, you know, there's this social contract thing. Well, we have done the social contract and we pretty much put our marble of sovereignty into the bowl and we've forgotten where our marble is. The Afghans always keep their hands on their marble. And when that bowl comes under attack, that bowl of nationhood comes under attack, they take the marble back and they become a tribe again, or they become a clan, or they become a family. And so when the capital is captured, what happens is Afghanistan dissolves into other units of social organization. So there was this hiatus that you all may remember between the fall of Kabul in November of 2001 and the fall of the Taliban regime. And I went up to the border, and it became clear to me quite quickly that, you know, the Taliban hadn't fallen. And they still owned Kandahar, and al-Qaeda was still manning the checkpoints, and people were getting hung for, you know, being involved in the anti-Taliban, you know, whatever you want to call it, opposition, and I reported that. And I got a scathing letter from this colleague of mine, whom I adored, and who told me, you are disseminating Taliban propaganda, and you have got to tell your listeners that you are interviewing pro-Bin Laden people, because why else would they be leaving Afghanistan when the regime is manifestly falling? And I'm thinking, we've got this stuff that's coming out of our bombers, right? You know, and there are terrified villagers, and they can't be running away from this bombing. I mean, or, you know, I'm watching trucks cross the border full of pomegranates. These guys are pro-Bin Laden, and even more complicated, as I say in the book, is pro-Taliban necessarily the same as pro-Bin Laden? I was realizing that these are different things, and that's what I was trying to report. And he didn't get it, and I was really shocked because this was a guy who had been out there. And then what happened is, as I ride into Kandahar and I hear from, I had been detailed a bodyguard by some other, you know, basically my best sources among this hodgepodge anti-Taliban militia thing, who had been gleefully pulling my leg the whole way, which you will also read about. But they did give me this bodyguard who had been involved in the fighting. And so I was aware that something weird had happened because President Karzai had appointed this other guy to be governor, whose name is Mullah Naqib. And then all of a sudden, Mullah Naqib is not going to be governor, and this guy, Gulagha Shirzai, is going to be governor. And I knew that there had been some hanky-panky in there. So I asked him, how did this happen? And he describes, you know, I'm thinking about a radio piece, so I need some imagery. You know, what did it look like? And so he describes these pickup trucks charging across the plain and the dust that they're rising and, you know, are throwing up behind them and the guns sticking out every window. And I knew that there was a group of special forces soldiers embedded with this proxy militia. That was no secret, and I had reported on it already. So I asked him, you know, what about the Americans? And what I had pictured was, you know, Gulagha Shirzai takes the bit in his mouth and charges off for Kandahar, and, you know, the Americans basically scramble to catch up. Lo and behold, the guy says, the Americans, they told us to do it. They encouraged us. And I was speechless. I said, oh my God, you know, here we are. Here is the nation-building process that the eyes of the world are riveted on and which may go quite a long way to determining what this 21st century is going to look like. And we're starting it out at cross purposes to ourselves. And so I wrote this into my story, and I get it nixed. It wasn't the whole story, but it was a part of the story. And to be fair, I've looked at the script since, And it was a little, it wasn't the clearest script that I've ever written in my reporting career, but bear with me. I had taken, you know, part in you know, cleaning the riffraff out of the, you know, Al-Qaeda barracks and all of this stuff, and I had had about 4.5 hours to put together this piece.
And I want to jump in to say, basically we're saying there was one special group of forces, U.S. forces, supporting one goal and another supporting another.
That's right. In other words, the town at that point didn't belong to the Taliban. The Taliban were gone. Al-Qaeda.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.